AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I've asked Frank Buckley to come back on Church and Culture today for a very specific reason. He's been on many times before and always to our benefit, but recently Pope Francis made some comments about populism, which I think need explanation and need exploration. Frank, as you know from hearing before, is a foundation professor at the Scalia School of Law, George Mason University here in Northern Virginia. He's also a weekly columnist for the New York Post. Most recent book, which we talked about when it came out, is The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America from Encounter. He's got a new book coming out from Encounter in November entitled Republic of Virtue, What We Felt About Corruption. That'll be a very interesting book to discuss when it comes out. Frank, thanks for coming back on the air with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Now, we have been hearing a lot about the word populism in terms of the election of Donald Trump, in terms of the upcoming election in France, and the apparent power of conservative groups, some more conservative than the other, the apparent rise of conservative groups in Germany, although I think they failed. I mean, in Holland and in Germany. In Holland, they failed to elect their person. But populism, am I correct in saying that populism, as it's being used now in political debates, is referring to this collective phenomenon?
Yeah, it is. And let me start out by saying, since you noted that the Pope has spoken of his concerns about populism, I'm a complete fan of the Pope. That's not to say, of course, I agree with everything, but yeah, I have a sense this is someone destined for sainthood.
That makes this interview even better, because you're a big fan of the Pope. He's my Pope.
I am a big fan, but you know what? You know, I think you've probably encountered or had the experience where you go to church and at some point in the sermon you kind of just tune out. And that becomes a very, very effective way of dealing with things you disagree with. You let that just slide.
Okay, well, let's explore what you think he means in his criticism of populism. But let me ask you this, though. Is the opposite of populism in politics elitism? What is the opposite of populism?
Well, populism is a compound noun that means many different things, most of them bad. And it's a term that's used in a sneering way by people who want to object to all of the things you've mentioned, but most particularly the policies of Donald Trump, which I support. And I think the sneer is unwarranted. I was in a debate with a number of people in New York a few weeks back, and one of them was Richard Lowry, who is the editor-in-chief of National Review magazine, and he kept talking about populism. And this was at the Harvard Club of New York, about 200 people there, pretty elite audience, and I guess I got my Irish up. So I turned to Lowry and I said, you've mentioned populism, but I have to tell you, I'm not aware that I am ill-bred as compared to you. I am not aware that I'm ill-educated as compared to you.
So, knowing Lowry, I can just see the look on his face. Keep going.
Yeah, curiously, at the end of it all, he didn't seem friendly. Gosh, figure. But, you know, so the people that tended to, this is not, of course, in reference to the Pope, but the people in America who tend to sneer about populism tend to be precisely the elite people that you spoke of, and they may be elite people on the right or elite people on the left. And what they want to do essentially is signal their superiority at an aesthetic level to the policies of Trump supporters. Right?
So Pope Francis says solidarity is the most effective antidote to modern forms of populism. This was an address to leaders of the European Union, 20 European heads of state there.
Yeah, solidarity is obviously very much a thing that needs to be promoted. I suppose the question
he calls populism and the fruit of egotism, which prevents hems people and prevents them from overcoming and looking beyond their own narrow vision.
Well, you know, it's a very complicated thing. And by the way, I would have thought that amongst all of our popes, probably the most populist is Pope Francis, in the sense
that's right. That I agree with you about that. Now, what is it that we're
from the
tradition
in Argentina?
Yes,
which he's not been entirely supportive of. A tradition of clearly populist. Leaders, Caudillo-type leaders, and that has made Argentina fall from one of the richest countries in the world in the 1930s to a country a bit of a basket case. So, the extreme left-wing policies adopted by that country have not been good for Argentinians. But I sort of see the point in a way. I mean, if populism were opposed to solidarity, populism would be a problem. Here's another way of thinking about it.
Meaning that it does split up people, communities into groups.
Yeah. If in the end it meant that we were more egotistical and less charitable, then it would be a problem. I don't think it is. I think it's just the opposite. In other words, I think that the members of the elite who sneer at populists are themselves not exactly, fine representatives of human solidarity. That the alternative to nationalism, which is the term I prefer to populism, may be not caring about anybody apart from yourself.
Okay, but let me sort of rephrase what I think the phenomenon is that is being tagged as populism, and this would include by Pope Francis. You have major developed countries of the world, United States, France, England. I didn't mention Brexit, which I'm sure he is including. The Netherlands, which is historically one of the most liberal countries in the world. Germany. And, of course, we could throw in Hungary, who have experienced in the last few years a protest by voters, not by people, duck stepping down the streets or beating people up, but by voters organizing under established parties and electing, in some cases, diselecting, but electing leadership who has very starkly different points of view on certain basic policies, both domestic and foreign, that have dominated those countries for, I suppose, decades. You have a fundamental protest against a guiding political and cultural vision of the last 30 or 40 years. That's what I see has happened and which is being called populism, but it's all being done in a legal way and according to the way in which our elected leaders are voted in all these different countries.
Absolutely right. This is part of the problem with the pejorative use of the term populism. It brings to mind Pat Buchanan's Peasants with Pitchforks and the Jacquerie in that old novel, The White Company, by Arthur Conan Doyle. They're going around burning castles and the like. And so the message basically is, you know, here we are defending civilization bravely at New Yorker magazine, but meanwhile you have all these people in West Virginia doing horrible stuff and smoking oxy and the like. And we're describing an aesthetic difference, and we're also describing a moral difference. These people are not merely aesthetically benighted, but they're morally impoverished as well, and we are the superior beings. So the people who talk about populism are basically validating the existence of a class divide between them and the majority of Americans, or at least half of Americans.
So, So what's the egotism then that Pope Francis is addressing? I mean, I don't understand. I don't see what's happened in this country in the election of Donald Trump as an expression of mass egotism.
No, egotism has nothing to do with it. And to the extent that there is some solidarity, a question of solidarity at issue, Trump's appeal was specifically on the basis of American nationalism. I think nationalism might be a better term here.
I think if he had criticized nationalism, I think I would have said, well, okay, but
nationalism, that would have made a bit more sense. Do you remember the movie Merry Christmas, Roy and Noel, that came out some years back?
Oh, wonderful movie, yes.
Yeah, and there's this wonderful scene. It's the Christmas Truce of 1914, and behind the trenches on the German side, somebody starts to sing Stille Nacht. And on the bagpipes of a Scottish regiment, somebody starts to play Silent Night. And eventually they all meet in the middle of no man's land. And the climax of the film, the padre from the Scottish regiment, who's Catholic, begins to say Mass, and the Germans join in, and the Scottish regiment joins in, and even the atheistical French join in. And it's a message basically about universal values triumphing over nationalism. And gosh, you know, World War I's a good example of where we could have used a bit more internationalism and less nationalism.
Yes, absolutely.
And traditionally that's where the church comes from. Right? I mean, traditionally the church is anti-nationalistic precisely because, in the sense that it's Catholic, that it's universal. So, you know, it speaks above war. You remind me, who was the Pope during World War I who was brokenhearted about the war? I've forgotten.
Benedict the 15th.
Benedict, that's right. You know, truly a saintly figure in himself. And so that's a sense in which there is something other than nationalism, which the church has always defended. And the church was a great international organization. It was, you know, the first great multinational.
And since Pope Francis was speaking at the European Union, and he obviously had Brexit in mind, he did say this. He said that this union will only be lasting and successful if the common will of Europe, quote, proves more powerful than the will of individual nations. Now, I am not in favor of a common will of Europe overcoming individual will of nations.
Right.
Because there's also a subsidiarity issue along with solidarity issues.
Absolutely right.
And the European Union has quashed subsidiarity.
Right.
In fact, the whole Trump phenomenon to me is a kind of protest on behalf of subsidiarity.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, we are tired of the elites who are, you know, notoriously in the Washington D.C. area trying to run the entire country, and so there was a kind of Brexit in America associated with the
yes.
campaign, which is why, you know, Trump welcomed Brexit, and Nigel Farage, the Brexit guy, is so much a supporter of Donald Trump. But you're absolutely right. I mean, that's not populism. It's not even nationalism. It's just pure, basic, simple economics. How do you govern a country so big? Do you want to split it down a little bit and evolve things down or not? And that's what Jean-Pierre Juncker versus Nigel Farage is all about as well. That's not populism. And it certainly has nothing to do with egotism or anything like that.
And especially when you're doing it using the ballot box. I mean, if you want to sneer at populism, I think you sneer at mass movements that involve violence, that involve disruption, which is, of course, exactly what some bishops have counseled anti-Trumpers to do. To sneer, what are the conditions under which it would be correct to sneer at populism, Frank?
Well, that's exactly where one should go. I mean, what we've set up to now is that it's wrong to label as populism things which are really something else, nationalism on the one hand, or a concern for subsidiarity versus rule by some junker in Brussels. So what are the bad things that are associated with populism? And one of them is the idea that it's unthinking, it's ill-educated.
Okay.
I mean, that was my comment to Rich Lowry, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you seem to think that I'm an idiot because I'm supporting Trump. I must be, therefore, a populist. I must, therefore, be a fool. But, Lowry, I don't think I'm stupider than you are. So the image, you know, the image these are basically your village idiots as compared to the sophisticated folks of New York and Washington.
Which points toward elitism. At least, the attitude of they are the intellectual moral elite.
It's a class difference. You know, it's impossible these days to pick up a copy of a major newspaper like the Washington Post, and particularly the New York Times, without a story about how benighted the backwoods people are back there in West Virginia and so forth. I find that just so contemptible. There was an incredible example of that in the Washington Post yesterday. They paid a visit to the county in America which has the lowest, where people are most likely to die most quickly, right? It's got the shortest lifespan of any country, of any county in America. And it's McDowell County in West Virginia, which is right across from Blacksburg, Virginia. It's West Virginia. And what they focused on was a fight club. And, you know, it's a coal mining area. The coal mines are closed down. Once a month, these people get welfare checks, and that weekend they have a fight club, and people are invited, if they're, so long as they're not professional fighters, to come to this fight club and box with each other. And in a town of 3,000 people, 2,000 people will go to that. And you also had scant.
It's like West Texas. Everyone goes to the college football game.
Well,
on Saturday night.
It's Friday Night Lights in Texas, but
right.
This is boxing where you get up and you try to knock the other guy out, and it's purely amateur, and it's really a blood sport. And, you know, and then they had, and so the winner gets $1,000, and they also have these scantily clad ring girls, you know, who all hold up the cards in between the rounds, and they get the winner there gets $1,000. And you read that, and you're reading about, I mean, what is supposed to be almost a lower form of life. I mean, it reminded me of something that a fellow in the Washington Post wrote about the religious right back right in 1993. He called them poor, uneducated, and ready to command, easy to command.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, like I say, I call it redneck porn. Contrast that with the honest socialist description of the underclass 50 years back. Michael Harrington's, mm-hmm. The Other American.
Right.
The way other, Jacob Riis's, the
much, very,
Half Lives.
Yeah, really good work. Really
good these
work.
These were guys who had a heart.
Yeah.
And if they were, you know, or, God, what's the novel about the Okies who moved to California?
Well, I'm thinking of John Howard Griffin, you know, for example, in Black Like Me, and, you know.
Yeah.
People have actually gone and empathetically explored these communities that in given time periods are dismissed by the elites, different sets of elites.
Who was the person you just mentioned?
John Howard Griffin.
Okay, I'll look him up.
Black like me, he turned his skin black in order to experience.
Oh, you're black like me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so this, you know, we're describing people who visited towns, communities, mm-hmm. less advantaged, but did so without condescending
right.
to them and showing empathy for them and feeling a common brotherhood.
Well, if I lived in that town, I'd go to it too. There's nothing else to do other than smoke meth.
Yeah, right. So,
you know,
that's
the only way to meet a girl and have a date.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, what are you supposed to do? Oh, I'm not going to that. I think I'd rather sit out here in the woods and watch cable TV, you know, or whatever.
Right.
Now, you know, I have to tell you a story, Frank. You'll appreciate this
yeah.
story. For three summers, I was Mortimer Adler's fellow at the Aspen Institute. And for listeners who don't know, Mortimer Adler was one of the inventors of the Great Books Program and editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica and founder of the Aspen Institute. And we would go out to dinner every night, and we'd have different discussions. And at one point, Mortimer looked at me and said, "Deal, don't you agree that people that live in rural areas, don't live in the cities, are stupid? They're basically stupid." And I said, "Absolutely not. Absolutely not." And I was shocked that he would even say it.
Yeah.
Because I found him to be much more reasonable and open-minded. But he was, you know, he grew up in New York City. He taught in Chicago. He lived in San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera. He had never lived in a place outside of a sophisticated urban setting.
Marx's line about the idiocy of rural life.
That's what brought it up. He quoted that. That's right. Thank you. That's where it came from, the idiocy of rural life.
But, you know, contrast that with, I won't say the Catholic, but the religious attitude towards people, which is they're your brothers. I mean, what I'm describing is the complete opposite in my, what I call redneck porn, is the exact opposite of solidarity. It's the expression. It's the sense of a difference with the underclass.
Yeah, it's contempt,
and a contempt for the underclass. And Marx felt great contempt for the lumpen proletariat. And these guys are just showing their contempt. And really, what they're trying to do is they're trying to explain two things. They're trying to explain why it is that people voted Trump. Well, you know, the point is they're populist and uneducated. And the other thing that I think is behind this literature is people are trying to explain why they're entitled to feel superior, right? Why they deserve
yes.
their good fortune. These people, I mean, the people who read these stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times, they read them and they hug themselves and they say, yes, yes, these poor people, and I'm so much superior to them and I deserve my good fortune, and they deserve their ill fortune.
You just stated... what could be the thesis for a whole other book? I mean, that deserves to be unpacked.
I'm writing it as it happens. I'm writing a history of the campaign called The Secret History after Procopius. But I just find this so repellent because, you know, I'm from, you know, a farming area. And you know, I'm talking about the kind of family that I came from. And these were honest, good people.
Well, I came from, you know, middle class folk in the beginning of my young life, lower middle class. By the time I got to college, solidly middle class. By the time I went to became an adult, my parents had, I think, graduated upper middle class. But, you know, I'm a basic Walker Percy American suburbanite. And I mean, what would the idiocy of rural life apply to that, or is somehow they got... They're more part of the urban elite.
Well,
where do they fall?
I don't know. I mean, Marx's lumpen proletariat was people who voted for Napoleon III. And so it's exactly basically what people think when they think about the lower class that votes for Donald Trump. You know, there was a guy called Thomas Frank who wrote a book called What's the Matter with Kansas?
Now, I remember that book,
and,
yes.
And the thesis of the book was, look, you know, I'm from Kansas, and people from Kansas vote reliably Republican, and what have the Republicans done for the lower class, right? So these guys, their big issue is stuff like religion, which really shouldn't count because, you know, the only thing that counts, that the only intelligent attitude towards this is atheism. So they have all these false ideas, but they're not voting their economic interest. Well, guess what? With Trump, people actually for once started to vote their economic interest. And they weren't voting for right-wing libertarianism. They were voting for jobs. And so Trump answers Thomas Frank's question. The question again was, what's the matter with Kansas? And the answer is nothing now. Nothing now with Trump.
And do you think Thomas Frank, is he still alive and kicking, and is he addressed
yeah,
the Trump
still
election?
Yeah, he's still kicking, and he's kind of figured it out. There are a number of Democrats who have realized that their party has become elitist, and he's one of them. He wrote a book called Listen, Liberal, which basically made fun of all of the, the condescension of the liberals who dominate the Democratic Party, you know, having kissed goodbye to ordinary workers.
Well, we should get him on the show and do a three-way conversation.
He's a smart guy. Other people have figured on the left have figured it out as well. I mean, honestly, Michael Moore has figured it out. I mean, he's figured out the issues are economic, and the Democratic Party doesn't care about ordinary Americans.
But he announced yesterday that the day before yesterday was the beginning of the end of the human race.
The beginning of the what?
The beginning of the end of the human race.
Oh, right, yeah, right.
because of the climate change policy of the Trump administration.
Well, apart from the fact that the end of the human race is almost a daily occurrence now.
We're going to be back with Frank Buckley. He is the foundation professor at the Scalia School of Law, George Mason University, right after this short message.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back for Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEO in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. St. Colette's in Livonia will be hosting a 3-hour evangelization workshop on Saturday, April 8th, featuring St. Paul Street Evangelization. You will learn a non-confrontational approach which allows the Holy Spirit to move in the hearts of those you are trying to reach. Pre-registration is $10, $15 at the door. To register, call 734-464-7925. Enjoy Catholic speaker and singer Steve Angrisano at Our Lady of Hope's Parish Mission April 9th through the 11th in St. Clair Shores. Steve's music and storytelling shares a passionate message of faith, hope, and love. For more information, call 586-771-1750. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
Back with Frank Buckley, who's become a regular on Church and Culture, and for good reason. His latest book, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America, I still claim is the best blueprint I know for the present administration and conservative movement in general, Republican Party, and Democrat for that matter, to think about how to restore America to it being the land of opportunity. Frank, I want to, since you're a fan of Pope Francis, I want to phrase a question this way. As Pope Francis looks at these movements in the United States and Europe that are challenging the elites, challenging the dominant political elites, including the European Union and so forth, and in some cases overturning them, as we have in the United States, what is it that he could have said, and how would he have said it, in terms of warning against whatever in these movements is dangerous?
Well, there are a number of things he could have said, and I never want to try to correct a sermon for a pope, but on the subject of populism generally, what can we say about that kind of populism, which is not healthy, not a good thing? And there are a number of things which are not things that he meant, I think. Populism is associated with dumb people. And dumb people do dumb things. And populist initiatives in the past have not always produced good results. And, of course, the best example of that is the Pope's native Argentina and the Peronistas. I mean, if you think of populists, you might readily think of the Perons and the Peronista movement, which had the effect of wrecking the Argentine economy. So that's not good. If that's what populism meant, then we don't want it. But I don't think that's what he meant, because he doesn't talk about economics much. He talked about solidarity. And if he had said there are things that weaken our sense of solidarity, without mentioning populism per se, or if he said populism is a problem to the extent it weakens our sense of solidarity, then I'm with him. But the point about that is the nationalist movements that we're seeing, or if you want to call them populist, I think tend to produce greater rather than less solidarity. And that the people who sneer at populists are people who don't feel a single bit of solidarity themselves to the people lower down in society.
And of course, not, while it helps solidarity, it also helps subsidiarity.
Yeah, right. So, and solidarity and subsidiarity is where you would find solidarity thrive. I mean, let's put it this way. You were referring to Friday Night Lights football in Texas. And, you know, I remember that from high school back in Western Canada, same diff. And, you know, when you went to one of those games, you rooted for your town against the neighboring town. And you didn't really feel bad about the neighboring town. But the point is, you can only root for one team if you root against the other team. So solidarity... One thing solidarity means is a sense that I am in solidarity with this community and not that community. I'm not universal in that sense.
This is my team. This is my community. This is who I identify with.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that at all. It's the only kind of solidarity that matters.
It's like we could say this is my family. No?
Yeah, the only solidarity that matters is this is my family, and I don't think that, for example, the state should scoop up babies and assign them randomly. And I think it's okay to root for my team as opposed to any other team. That's the only kind of solidarity that humans can have.
What if Rich Lowry had said to you, well, Frank, look at one of the first things the Trump administration did, went out and wants to defund the National Endowment for the Arts and that probably the National Endowment for the Humanities. I mean, doesn't that prove my point about the importance of education?
Well, if education lay in the hands of the national endowments, then we're in far greater trouble than even I thought we were. I don't think, you know, the people who gave us Piss Christ, for example, at the NEA are people, you know, who are the bearers of civilization and education. The alternative to, and by the way, I would be opposed to the abolition of the NEA. I think you could do good things with it.
Well, Dana Gioia did great things with the NEA.
Dana did great stuff. I think
it's an example of, yeah.
I mean, the guys, you know, my model in this respect are some guys who, did this under Stephen Harper's government in Canada. They produced Heritage Minutes, and if you ever get onto YouTube and click Canadian Heritage Minutes, you'll get these 60-second videos, which aired on TV, which are really moving. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, some
well, my son has been watching them. My son's been watching them.
It's all about promoting, you know, nationalism. And when you think of the way in which America is regularly calumniated in schools and universities and in the press, it might not be a bad thing to have some positive message about the great things about this country.
Now, why don't you and I go take over the NEH and do that, if it's still existing?
Yeah. Well, you know, the current NEH, I don't know enough about the NEH, but the current NEA doesn't seem to be the place you would turn for that.
No, the answer to Lowry's question that I put in his mouth is this, that the NEA and the NEH have burned so many bridges with the taxpayer, turned so many bridges with people of goodwill. I mean, even people that want them to be there, that they made it impossible to defend their existence.
Right. I don't think we'd notice the difference much if they weren't around in the end. I
mean, well, there are certain groups of artists and academics who would.
Yeah. Well,
but remember when NEH created the Great Library of America series?
I don't know if they did, but
they did. Jeff Wallen was part of that.
Because that is superb.
Yeah.
I have I have about 50 of those things.
They did. It was at Jeff Wallen's desk, who's a mutual friend of ours, that project grew out of. Yes.
Absolutely splendid. Dana Gioia said, by contrast, that when he took over the NEA, he found that it was an organization by, of, and for a bunch of mutual back scratchers in New York City.
Yeah. And so he's been on Church and Culture and talked about his time at NEA. And I mean, and you can't even get in a one-hour show all the great programs that Dana started and implemented at, you know, regarding Shakespeare, regarding poetry, regarding just reading great books. I mean, on and on and on. It was amazing what he was able to get done. So we go back to we go back to this issue then of what is wrong with what is happening in the United States, in Italy too, in France, the challenging of the dominant elites, political and media elites, and institutional and intellectual elites. What is really wrong with what's going on? I mean, you can look at Le Pen. I mean, is Le Pen guilty of something that I don't know about? Is it?
Well, I don't know about her. I suppose perhaps I can more confidently talk about her father as being a bit of a
anti-Semite.
Yeah, anti-Semite.
But France in general has that problem, in my opinion.
Not as much. I've spent time there as you have. I've never detected that in any way. But You don't have to go far back in French history to find...
It's the only country in the world I've ever been in where people... It's the only country I've ever been in where people openly say anti-Semitic things. Maybe I just was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but... Going back to the question, what is wrong with these movements? Is there anything at the heart of these movements, Frank, that is worthy of a sustained
criticism? I see them as simply nationalistic, and to that extent promoting a greater rather than a less sense of solidarity. But there's an aspect to something related to populism which might be troubling, and there the Pope might be right, and that's the idea of resentment. Right? The idea that our problems are caused by somebody else, and rather than having a sense of solidarity and openness and love for other people, rather you spend time focusing on just the opposite, on the most negative kinds of emotions, of hatred and contempt and ridicule for other people. And you could think of times in history where that precisely was the case. I mean,
it certainly led to the rise of the Nazi Party, no question.
Yeah, the Nazi Party specifically. So the question is, are there any Nazis around? And that's just silly, right? I mean, it's obviously not.
But it's the first time in the history of ideas that I can think of resentment being used is Max Scheler.
Taylor is exactly the fellow who wrote about it. That was in the 1920s, and he died before the rise of a Nazi party, though he had already seen its beginnings in Germany. That kind of resentment looks for scapegoats. It looks for people to hate rather than people to open your heart to. It kind of rewards the hater. Is there anything of that in amongst Trump supporters?
Yes.
Think to any.
Yes, there is.
But I'm sure it exists.
Yeah. You put your finger. This is why I've been pushing you. You put your finger exactly on what I think ought to be criticized, in these movements we're seeing, especially, and I know firsthand in the United States, because this hate that has bubbled up to the surface, and people aren't checking it. I mean, they aren't looking in the mirror and saying, wait, this is not helpful. This is not going to create a better future for us.
Yeah. At the same time, I don't, this is entirely impressionistic, I don't know of any time when there was less racism, bigotry, with respect to most Americans. I mean, anti-Catholic bigotry, boy, that's long gone. Well, maybe it's coming back.
There's always a pocket.
It's not there. Yeah. It's not there the way it was. I mean, anti-black bigotry, not at all, I think. You have to dig pretty deep underneath a bedrock to find the true nasties who espouses. They're there. Okay, do you know where you're more likely to find it? You're more likely to find it not on the right, but not on the Trump right, but on the libertarian right. I mean, Charles Murray got into a spot of trouble at Middlebury College, and which behaved terribly to them and refusing to permit him to speak. But he's a fellow who makes his career over the last 20 years talking about differences in IQ levels. And I regard that as a rather horrible subject. When his book, The Bell Curve, came out, some of my libertarian colleagues were secretly greatly pleased. It validated how they were superior to other people because they were academics and therefore smart and therefore they were more worthy. Whereas I think just the opposite, that it's the people who are slower who are more worthwhile than my colleagues.
I was actually connected to AEI when that book came out through Crisis Magazine.
He worked then and works now at AEI. and is a libertarian. He was a prominent anti-Trump supporter. But the people who separate themselves out from other people and feel contempt for them, we're talking about the libertarian right for the most part. They go around saying they believe in open borders and all of that, but in fact, they know nobody who would be so affected by open borders. Really, it's a matter of sticking it in the eye for the closed borders, the immigration reform types. I don't see much love and solidarity from that crowd.
I was going to say, the reason I mentioned I was connected to AEI through Crisis Magazine and Michael Novak when that book came out is because I was deeply troubled, not by what was said, but what was unsaid. And you put your finger on what I felt was kind of implied by that book and the interest that so many people had in it at the time.
There was a really troubling interest in that book. It revealed a guilty secret, the sense of superiority one had over everyone else, the sense that also of entitlement. I mean, as we were smarter, therefore we deserve more, and that distinguished us from the people in McDowell County.
Sounds to me like another part of the political spectrum has taken that attitude over.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, nothing could be more anti-religious and more specifically anti-Catholic. And we've spoken about St. John Vianney in the past, right? I mean, the Kierkegaard, he's kind of the lovable saint of slow people.
Pure intuition.
And one could have a great reverence for him.
Yeah, of pure intuition. You know, he's not conceptual knowledge. He just feels it. He just knows it. This is why, that's why I was so drawn to the Catholic philosophy of Jacques Maritain, because it was all built upon the importance of intuitive knowledge, not just in the arts, but in spirituality, philosophy, epistemology, everything.
Yeah, it's extremely Catholic in the sense that it appeals to the emotions and not simply to the intellect.
Well, the emotions become the vehicle of knowledge.
Yeah, right.
If
you pick your friends on the basis of are they intelligent, then you've missed what's worthwhile in life.
Well, that's an interesting. We actually have another show on that because, Aristotle's notion of three levels of friendship, starting with those of mutual use, mutual enjoyment, and then sharing of the vision of the common good together. I have found that common vision with people from all walks of life, and from all levels of education. It doesn't require a PhD, to see, to have a worldview, right?
Yeah. And it is specifically Catholic to recognize that. And once you do, then you feel, I think, immediately, not a sense of difference so much from other libertarians as a sense that they've missed the purpose of it all. There's something lacking in them, ordinary humanity.
Let me give you one more quote from Pope Francis here in the last few minutes, and you can gloss this as a way of coming to a conclusion. Pope Francis said that one has a sense that in Europe there is a growing split between the citizenry and the European institutions. And that, I think, is what we're arguing with him about, is whether or not that split is a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, the European institutions are, the ones situated in Brussels, of course, or one would feel separate from them. That which made France distinctive was its peculiarities. It's Charles de Gaulle talked about 600 different flavors of cheese. How can you govern a country like that? He said that's precisely what.
Or with 15 languages, for that matter.
Yeah, right. So the solidarity is essentially a homely virtue of people who live close amongst each other. You know, it's opposed by universalism, which is Catholic in a way. But Catholicism, universalism is not about solidarity. Rather, it's about a break upon the excesses of local solidarity, of particularism. It should be a break that tells you, here's where solidarity ends, right? World War One being...
Well, it's a reminder of human nature and natural rights and the dignity of the human person, right? Which is
right.
Implicitly something that transcends nationalities and so forth.
Right. Universalism is a matter of cold logic, of abstract moral rules, not of warmth of feeling.
And so we have a valid universalism when it reminds us that there's a measure out there to what a nationalism or a populism ought to be driving toward.
Yeah.
The universalism being I guess another word is the common good, but what happens when, though, universalism, you attempt to concretize universalism with one world government?
Yeah. The Pope tries, not always with success, to abstain from clear political directions. Or if he does, he'll hedge them immediately afterwards. So I think we can absolve them from the charge of saying impolitic or uninformed ideas about all of this. In short, he agrees with us.
But then going back to your interesting point about him coming from a country that was ruined by a populist movement, do you think he would agree with your comment on that?
Well, he wasn't. He was often at odds with the government of Argentina, which, of course, as he was a bishop in Argentina, he's dealing with a very different group of people. He's dealing with Carlos Menem, who's a kind of a right-wing figure, and he's dealing with General Galtieri, who gets Argentina involved in a stupid war with England. The Peronista impulse was a preference for the lower classes, but the means it used were profoundly stupid. And the Pope's not an economist and can be, I guess, forgiven for ignoring that. Although if you just visit Argentina, you're immediately struck by the fact that everything that good that happened seemed to have happened before 1935.
And when you talk about a preference for the lower classes, are you talking about something that is...
A preferential option for the poor.
Yes. Catholic version, not a Marxist version.
Yeah, right.
So in a certain way, he was formed by that, and it's odd that, like you say, it's odd that he would use the phrase populism as something, as a negative sense, as a term for criticism.
Well, salvation is of the individual and not of the state, and when he's talking about populism, he's talking not about politics or the state, but of individuals and the individual heart. And what he's saying is that there is a way in which you can be misled away from solidarity with other people, towards egotism, which is the wrong word. And that's individually a bad thing. That is, the individual can sin or stumble by too closely identifying with, your local group.
Or being led into hatred as a means toward a political end.
Right. Exactly right.
Frank, thanks for being my guest again on Church and Culture. And I want to remind our folks that you have a weekly column with the New York Post. And what does that come out on a given day?
No, it's somewhat irregular.
And you've been since 1989. at the Scalia School of Law, George Mason University, Northern Virginia. And in a few months, we'll see your book come out, Republic of Virtue, What We Felt About Corruption. And again, I want to recommend those who are listening to take a look at Frank Buckley's The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. He makes great sense. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you so much, Chief.
And for all of you who are listening, we'll be back on this day at this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net. Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Jesus often stayed with Lazarus in Bethany, but when he arrived this time, he found that Lazarus had been in the tomb for 4 days. And Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." And Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise." And Martha said, "I know he'll rise at the resurrection on the last day." Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, even if he dies, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" And she said to him, "Yes, Lord. Do you believe it too?" And Jesus then became perturbed and said, "Where have you laid him?" So he came to the tomb, it was a cave with a stone across it, and said, Jesus said, "Take away the stone." And Martha said, "Lord, by now there'll be a stench. He's been dead for 4 days." And Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you, if you believe, you'll see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you for hearing me. But so they may believe that you sent me," he cried out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, tied hand and foot with burial bands, and his face was wrapped in a cloth. And Jesus said, "Untie him and let him go." This was a major miracle, and Jesus did it so that you might believe in the resurrection from the dead. Do you? I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the reading read this Sunday at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, on the fifth Sunday of Lent in the Byzantine liturgical calendar, it takes the story of a desert woman and the priest had found her to tell us about our deepest desires.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
The story of Christian higher education in America is a sad saga. Once upon a time, our universities were run by religious people or founded with religious missions. Not anymore. And yet a few jewels have held firm to the foundation. Two colleges that have actually heightened their faith commitment are Franciscan University of Steubenville and Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where I teach, one Roman Catholic and the other Protestant. The period when the two institutions successfully struggled to retain their faith commitments came in the 1970s and 1980s under the long-term leaderships of two particular presidents, Father Michael Scanlon and Dr. Charles McKenzie. My occasion for mentioning this now is the death of Father Scanlon at the age of 85. For 37 years, he led Franciscan. But I want to report an interesting and unseen ecumenical item related to Scanlon's and McKenzie's efforts, a joint effort. During some trying days, Scanlon and McKenzie frequently exchanged phone calls, advising and encouraging one another. Here were Catholics and Protestants working together, united by a common secular foe. "Father Scanlon and I were on the same wavelength," McKenzie told me, "as we sought to lead our schools back to the roots of the Christian faith. We were very careful what we said to each other.